I just realized I've got chocolate stains all over my pants. I had a Belgian waffle.
Right.
And it had ice cream with chocolate syrup, and I guess I poured it all over my pants, and I didn't even realize, and it's dried on my pants. Anyways.
So far away from home, eh?
Yeah.
This is the you end up Danish with chocolate experience. All over your pants. I'm here with Canadian filmmaker extraordinaire, podcast. Yes. Should I say junkie? I guess the
podcast
junkies.
Junkie, sure.
The junkies are mostly the fans, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
So I say head junkie, or co-head.
I would say a podcast junkie is appropriate because this week I'm going to be doing 3 podcasts.
Okay.
So that would be a junkie.
That's addiction.
Yeah, that is.
Anyway, your name.
My name is Jay Cheel.
Jay Cheel.
I am the co-host of the Film Junk podcast and the lead host of the Documentary Blog podcast.
In the interest of full disclosure, I will say that this is actually a pretty momentous occasion for me because I've been listening to Film Junk and thusly Jay's voice for about 5 years. I remember the first podcast I heard was the review of X-Men 3,
okay.
Which I think is around 5 years ago.
Probably. It's actually very weird to think that it's been that long that we've been doing it. It has to be one of the longest running movie podcasts on the internet.
Yeah.
Like there are some that started earlier but then stopped or became less, you know, it would be every once in a while, but we've been doing it like almost every week for over 5 years now.
So. Yeah, and if you count, the podcast is called, of course, the Film Junk Podcast. It's available on iTunes and wherever. Mm. But if you count before that, you did Space Junk, which was basically the same, but the same people, but the content was a little different.
Yeah, it wasn't as focused on just film.
It was more focused on space
and junk.
More junk.
But it was like this. It actually started as a university radio program.
Right.
And it was Sean at Sean's university. He's the co-host, or basically the host of Film Junk.
Yeah, and also the head writer of the site.
Yeah.
And so the head honcho.
Yeah, he controls everything there. So we started on the university, and that was before podcasting.
Yeah.
But even when we were at the university, Sean was putting MP3s of the shows up on the university website. So it wasn't technically podcast because it wasn't like an RSS feed.
Right.
But it was available online. So
yeah.
If you count that, then we are definitely a very early running podcast. But
yeah,
we're
definitely
still doing it.
Predates the word.
Yes, yes. But he was very excited. I remember when he first discovered podcasting and he was very excited to try it out, and then it just stuck, and I think we're doing our 300th show in like a couple weeks or something, so whatever that works out to over 5 years, right? We've probably missed maybe 5 shows.
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the big deal. It's I can only remember maybe 3 or 4 weeks without a show, which is pretty astounding.
And it's only when like someone's on vacation or something. So it's pretty. That's dedication.
Yeah, it is dedication. Especially since it's not like you do it professionally or anything.
Right.
I mean, you all have jobs on the side.
Yeah, it's all just.
Or at least some of
fun.
You, I guess. Reed, he doesn't have a job anymore, and he's not even on every week.
Yeah, but it's. I don't know. For me, it's just a good excuse to get together with friends and talk about films. And if we didn't do the podcast, we wouldn't see each other as often. And it kind of leads to other things like the video stuff that we do and the website, writing for the website. And so it's been fun.
Yeah, it's great once you have this sort of you know, some sort of audience at least. It's very motivating.
Well, you were there when we had no audience.
Right.
Which is funny.
Yeah, I would say I'm probably one of the originators of the Film Junk audience.
Yeah. Which I remember when we started doing like a mail, we do the junk mail section on the show. And when we first started doing that, it was another regular, Corey, who's called Goon.
He's on the show from time to time.
He would write in as other people.
Really?
Because we had no listeners.
But. Oh, I had no idea. I remember like one of the very first... it was like maybe it was Superman Returns, mm-hmm. where you had like sort of asking people to write in about the most gay movie or something. I remember writing in at that point. It was like me and another guy, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it definitely snowballed, I would say, somewhat.
Yeah.
I mean, junk mail is filled every week now.
It's grown. I mean, probably not as fast as things normally would grow. Like, we're still not. You know,
well, you're things with integrity, they grow slow, right?
That's true. That is true.
Yeah, not selling out anywhere.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's grown, and we've got. I think Sean, the last time he checked, it was like every new episode we get around, I think 1,700 to 2,000 downloads the week that it comes out.
Oh,
and then you continue with the archives and everything.
Yeah.
So
I actually remember like. Yeah, this is, it's actually pretty funny because, you know, my history of Film Junk is basically go through all my adult life. And I remember at one point I did ask Sean, like, how many download the podcast? And this must have been like 3 years ago. This was mm-hmm. before that seemed like there was mm-hmm. any sort of, and there was a time as well where Sean sort of publicly expressed thoughts about stopping the show and stopping the website because mm-hmm. it just felt like, well, it's not really worth it, and other people rip off your stuff, and you're never going to go anywhere, etc. Yeah. And at that point, the podcast had, like, I think it said 300 downloads.
Yeah.
So it definitely has grown. And I'm not really sure how big podcasts get. Like, what's a massive amount of downloads? I don't really know.
I don't know either. Like, I don't know if that number is substantial or...
No.
I'm sure it isn't.
You did get a sponsor, though.
Yeah, although it's one of those weird sponsors where, like, I think it's kind of like Google Ads.
Yeah,
everyone grabs that sponsor. It's not like it's a specific sponsor us, but I don't know. It's better than nothing, I guess.
Although definitely.
It's not like we see tons of money from that.
No, but at least it helps keep the site running.
Yeah, I think it helps in a weird way when people... like new listeners download it and they hear a sponsor ad.
Yeah.
It makes it just sound more professional.
Yeah, that's probably true, yeah.
Yeah, like having ads on a site, I think it makes it feel like for people looking for movie news especially that they're on a site that might actually, you know, be pulling from sources that are, you know, trustworthy and
right.
Even though most of blogging isn't trustworthy, it's a lot of rumors and
basically when you have to do like 7 or 8 news posts a day, you're gonna have to post about a lot of shit that might not end up actually coming through.
Yeah, it's just like
the sort of the nature of blogging,
perpetuating rumors until they're it's discovered that they're wrong.
The snake eating its own tail.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know, that's why, for me, the podcasting is more interesting than blogging. I think just, it's less disposable, and it just feels more like you're doing shows, and that the idea that people can go through the back archives, and like, you know, when we have people saying that they just discovered the show and they've been listening to the back episodes for the last month, is cool, because, you know, I think of like, when I discover a TV show and then I know there's like 5 seasons previous to where I jumped in that I can then go back and dig through.
Yeah.
That I love doing that. So for anyone who really enjoys the show to come in at episode number 298 and know that they've got, you know, 297 shows that they can check out before that, I think is awesome. Although I think the first 100 shows probably aren't very good.
Probably a bit, well, at least compared to what the show is now, it's quite a bit different. And I guess the first 60 or so Space Junk episodes as well.
Yeah, something like that.
And those are definitely very different.
Yeah.
And they don't sound
both
as good.
Both technically and content-wise, but it's gotten better.
Production quality is pretty, because when I met you for the first time yesterday, you sounded exactly like on the podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is actually kind of fucked up, because for these past 5 years I've been listening to, and you have talked me, you and Sean and Greg talked me to sleep like more times than I can remember. And for the first time it was like, well, here's this voice that's like, probably 1.5 million times I wanted to say something too, because for whatever reason something comes up and I'm like, whatever, trying to, and this is the first time that it's actually responding.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a funny thing to get used to.
Yeah, it's weird. It's doing the podcast, I think it's helped with because I am going into filmmaking and I have my first film coming out, and when I was doing meetings about the film, and I would have to answer questions about the movie and like reasons why I'm including this shot or why I want to do this or that, doing the podcast for the last 5 years, and like, because we don't prepare the show, like we just come in and sit down and talk,
so sort of like this show.
Yeah, we don't have notes or anything, so being able to talk about films off the top of your head, not that we're amazing at it yet, like I think we've gotten better, but that ability to talk like that has helped in those scenarios, like being able to
trying to explain your own film to outsiders.
So it's I like that it's become kind of like I guess a training ground for just holding conversations, which can be much harder than you think.
Like, definitely trying to actually think of something that's worthwhile to say on the fly,
especially in a meeting where people are expecting you to have answers for everything. So it's helped in that way, I think, and just watching films and being able to, I try not to watch a movie and have the podcast in my head the whole time, but it's a good exercise afterwards to sit down with everyone and discuss it, and it makes you more sensitive to what you're watching and why you like something or why you don't like something.
Yeah.
Even though, sometimes I think, whether it be in podcasts or in blogs, a lot of movie discussion is very, it's very like emotional and
gut reaction. And
I'm more about gut reactions to films than
intellectual. You did not coin the phrase, even though some people thought so. But you did sort of become a big proponent of the phrase, it is what it is.
Yes, yes. That phrase holds a lot of meaning.
That's movie
yet
discussion.
No meaning at all. Yeah. But I like to talk about films from... I experience films more viscerally than intellectually, I think.
Yeah.
And it just I think that creates an interesting environment when you sit down to talk about a film, because you end up discussing things that go into intellectual areas, but then bringing that visceral perspective to it, I think adds an interesting, it starts an interesting discussion. And none of the guys on the podcast are really film experts or
not in the sense that they haven't studied it and like work in the
like it's not an academic
no that's exactly
which is it's nice. You have to ride that line between, because there's so many fan sites out there that are very, I think, narrow-minded and only focus on one thing, and to have a show that is both fan oriented but is willing to broaden the perspectives
and also like sort of standing your ground against this sort of, because also you get these sites who are they set their site on something like a certain movie or a certain trend, mm-hmm. and then it's just like for weeks on end just pummeling with news and whatever opinion pieces about the same thing over and over again, and that also leads to like relationships with studios and stuff. I've noticed where it's like if you just sort of pick some movie and hype it up like with everything you've got, then you might, you know, be invited to the set. Yeah. And that'll be like, oh man, I'm just some sort of film fan, and they want me on the set, and I've made my life's goal.
Yeah.
And then it's very easy to just fall into that trap again and again and again. So like, well, I gotta keep this good relationship with the studio, yeah, so I get to do all these awesome things.
And yeah, and you end up becoming, you know, someone who's unknowingly shilling for the studio. And I know Sean is one thing that recently I've been kind of not dealing with, but that has come up is the idea of doing interviews.
Right. Because
on the documentary blog podcast that we just started, we've been interviewing documentary filmmakers, and I've never been totally interested in interviews, mainly because I usually they're not very, to me, they're not very interesting.
No, I can, as I've done some interviews for the radio and whatnot, and I find it incredibly difficult to figure out what the fuck is a good question.
It can be very, it can be intimidating, but it can also be sort of like you can almost overthink things because you're like, I want to ask that perfect question that no one's asked. But sometimes I think the more simple it is, the better, because it just becomes conversational.
Yeah.
And with the documentary blog podcast, that's what I'm hoping to do with that is we've been bringing documentary filmmakers in and just having, there is an interview aspect, but we try to get them to take part in the whole show.
And
conversational feel to it. But then you run the risk of, you know, if there's a guest that did a film you didn't like, or you're going to review the film that, you know, you just had this person on the show and then you give them a 4 out of 4, and then people think, oh, you're just giving them a 4 out of 4 because they were on your show.
Obviously.
And so it opens that door, but it almost feels like to eliminate the possibility of doing interviews just because you're scared people might think you're biased is a disservice to, you know, the I guess podcasting, like the interest of doing, bringing people on and having them talk about things. Because I think if you are really worried that people might think you're changing your opinions to please a guest or something, then don't do it. The only way to combat that is to be honest. And like, I haven't had to deal with anything like that yet, but I know we've talked about some films and filmmakers and not the best light. And then if, you know, that person were to ever be on the show, it would just have to exist as, I didn't like your film.
Yeah.
You'd have to try and be as honest as you can about it, but
Definitely, I think that the only way to sort of quell any rumors or any like rumblings that you might be biased is just to, you know, if you yourself are aware that you are not biased, then that's all you can do, really.
Yeah.
It becomes a problem if you do fall into that thing where it's like, well, if I just do this, then he might be on the show and I'll get all these listeners, and I've been told not to swear as much. I was about to say you're effing yourself in the A.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to keep the F bombs to a minimum.
This is university radio, right? You can't have the F bombs every other week.
No, we are as opposed to film junk, we are extremely academic here.
Yes. But yeah, very highbrow. It's been fun so far. We haven't had any filmmaker guests on film junk.
No.
But I think it'd be interesting.
Well, you.
Yeah, I guess if you can count me. But
well, this is sort of, you know, I'm very happy that you're here, and it's all very exciting. And this is sort of, you know, I'm not going to say, well, it might be a little bit sort of a film junk fluff piece, you know, because I'm such a big
fan.
This
is where you have to insult me so people know that you're not biased.
Oh, right. Well, I'm not going to. if anybody's interested in me insulting people like Jay or other
just
people on Film Junk,
go
to the comment section from like 3 to 5 years back, and you'll see very many sort of a lot of bile from a young, lonely, frustrated man, sometimes drunk, sometimes sober. It's not always easy to tell. Anyway, you mentioned that you have made a film now, But it's not like you just decided to make a film because of the podcast, right? I mean, you have been making films.
I mean, I've been making films in one way or another since I was like 13.
Yeah.
But I went to school for it, and the podcast kind of paralleled that in a way. But the podcast came from an interest in film, and you know, filmmaking didn't come from the podcast.
No.
So I've done videos for Film Junk here and there, which has come in handy. Like,
well, I think you're doing yourself a disservice by calling them videos, because especially recently, a lot of it has been like short films.
Yeah,
like it could actually play as a short film.
Yeah,
whether or not it's intended to.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm glad you think that, because I think that's one thing that the site does better than a lot of other movie-related sites is our video content.
I can't think of another site that has something like that. At least not nowhere near like the level of sort of competence involved and the effort trying to make it actually worthwhile to watch. I mean, a lot of people have like a video review. It's like a guy talking into a camera and something. I call it, well, this is the video stuff that we do, but that's not at all what this is.
No, whenever we do video stuff, I like to try and turn it into a film, a production. And I think the fact that, you know, I have confidence in my abilities with filmmaking, and then I have a bunch of people that I'm friends with that happen to be good in front of the camera, like Jerry and Sean, and
this Sean is great, great in front of the camera.
Yeah, but I mean, we have done like short Halloween videos and stuff, and Reed Farrington, I've done videos on him, and we just had Cooking with Jerry play at a film festival, which is a short we did for the site.
Now, for people who aren't as familiar with this as you and I, mm-hmm. maybe we should clarify. You have a friend who's called
Jerry Farrington. His name is Jerry. He didn't want his real name used on the site, so I came up with a fake name, Reed Farrington, and that's stuck. And I worked with him. I used to work at a video game company with Sean and Jerry, where we did like Xbox 360 video games and stuff. And so I would spend lunch hour with Jerry every day, and we have a deep rooted friendship that is very complex, because we argue a lot and we get under each other's skin, I think, but it's...
Well, with him, you would have to be the most lenient person in the world to never get into an argument with him,
right.
I would say.
He's very polite when you first meet him. He's the most polite person to strangers, but as soon as you get to know him, he starts challenging you and challenging the idea of being friends with him. But I've stuck it out, and we have done videos now touring his house. He's got this sort of crazy house where he collects Star Trek memorabilia and plush
keeps,
toys.
And keeps, like, pop he didn't drink in the fridge.
He's kind of a hoarder. But, we started a podcast called Cantankerous, where we kind of have talked about our friendship and other weird subjects.
And that podcast is actually amazing.
Yeah, I think people seem to enjoy it, and we should probably do it more often.
You should.
The fact that it's so spread out almost seems like it's keeping it...
Well, it's keeping the podcast itself pretty cantankerous.
Yeah. It seems appropriate, but he's kind of one of the characters, which is what I think is cool, is that with Film Junk, we're at a point now where we're getting people listening, and it's almost like we have characters on the show, and I think... Even though I know Sean's not really a fan, and I'm kind of a fan, but the Howard Stern show has a similar thing where they build characters, and their show is like one of the... I don't know, is he popular here, Howard Stern?
Well, I don't think he's even on the radio or anything.
Oh,
but
I guess he's on satellite, right?
Yeah, so. He's an international celebrity, so people will know who he is, I guess.
Well,
but I've never heard a show of his.
Okay, well, he's kind of just written off as being very extreme and like a shock jock and all about, you know, offending.
Yeah.
But his show is kind of one of the first reality shows only on radio, because he has all these, like, this cast of characters that he brings in, and the listeners get to know everyone and kind of relate to one person, or, and I think that's interesting, and he's really good at interviewing people. You wouldn't think he is, but he can really make someone comfortable. And
actually, I did hear something from Howard Stern. I heard Kevin Smith, you know, the filmmaker Kevin Smith, you know him, of course. Yeah. You know, I follow him on Twitter because he's awesome on Twitter, and he linked to some I can't remember which movie it was. I think it was Jersey Girl, and he was on the Howard Stern show and trying to promote it, and Howard Stern sort of, I wouldn't say beat him down, but he was kind of like, he was talking about him like he wasn't a real director.
In sort of
a snidey way, like you would expect someone like Howard Stern, like he's always on and trying to entertain, and you know, and apparently Kevin Smith, like, he didn't like it at all. He is sort of sensitive. It seems like when he has a new movie coming out, all of a sudden his sensitivity is like off the charts with everything.
He seems very his confidence seems very low. He seems to overcompensate for something. But I like him.
I don't like his movies, but the podcasts are great.
The best thing that he's ever done.
I would agree totally.
Which is weird because his humor in the podcast, it's still kind of, you know, the raunchy humor.
Dick and fart jokes and stuff.
But it's funnier than that. Like he
definitely.
The relationship he has with like Scott Mosier and all the other people, They're very funny guys, and I think the movies do a disservice to how funny they actually are.
Yeah, it's kind of sad because it seems like almost well, this is not going. We're going to talk about Kevin Smith's podcast. I will just say this, that after listening to all of the podcasts and all the different ones, it's almost like apart from. I would say Kevin Smith is almost like he is, he's almost like the least funny of the people on the show. And I almost wish that like the other people would make the movies and Kevin Smith could be a guest because he's good at like hosting and, and like trying to make something accessible to an audience when they're telling a story and whatnot. But all the other guys are so fucking funny that it's
Scott Mosier is.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Funny.
So why doesn't he make some movies?
Yeah. But yeah.
Anyway, maybe it'll come in the future. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. But
anyway, I wanted to talk about Beauty Day, which is your new movie, which unfortunately is not here at Copenhagen Ducks this year.
It's not even really finished yet. The cut is finished, but we have to do like the audio mix and the color correction,
and
we just got a composer. So right now, I'm working with him on getting all the music set for the film.
Which, so he's writing new music for the film?
Yeah. All of the instrumental stuff that I've had in there as like temp tracks will be taken out, and a composer is going to do the score. And then we've got a handful of like pop songs that will remain. But that's been an interesting process, the music licensing. It's a very expensive thing. And
For a movie that is like no budget.
Yeah, our budget is so tiny. It's like, I think probably like a quarter of our budget is for music licensing. And the 9 songs that I want in there will take up that whole budget plus more. So we had to hire a composer or else we wouldn't be able to, you know, license the music.
But have a silent film.
Yeah. But I think it's a good thing because when I was filling the movie with temp tracks, it just felt like it was all over the place, whereas now it will feel cohesive.
Yeah.
And it'll give the film more of an identity with the music and whatnot. But
and it's also great, like, I don't know who the composer is or whatever, but just having another creative person trying to, you know, get their own spin on telling the same story.
Yeah.
It can
Even
only lead
for me,
to good
like,
results.
Yeah, I'm a music fan, so being able to...
I'm a music fan.
But, is that weird?
Well, who isn't a fan of music? I mean,
but I mean,
I hate music.
I like music.
Yeah, music is one of my favorite things.
Yeah, and reading.
Yeah.
But like I've
worked. You're into
I've
music.
Written music before as well.
Yeah, right.
I scored a couple of films that we've done in the past. So. Seeing a professional doing it, and being able to have them, like, being open, them being open to me saying, like, okay, I'd like this instrument here, or can you try this, or, you know, do that. And the conversations we've been having so far have been very interesting to me in terms of, like, capturing tone with music and whatnot.
Do you want to give out your sort of artist name for the music that you did?
The contract isn't actually the
contract. No, I'm not talking about the. No, I didn't mean the composer. I meant like the music that you did.
You mean the songs that I did?
Yeah, like what was called Boat versus Whale.
I did a couple songs under a name, J Pride Parade, right. Which is a take on the Gay Pride Parade.
Which is why I wanted to mention.
But music is just. It's hard. I wanted to actually try and write an album, and I got 3 songs done, and I kind of gave up because it's just I find, and this was reflected in my editing as well, that I'm good at like sections, but arrangement is tough for me.
Okay,
and with music, it's the same thing. Like I'll write a good chorus, and then I'll have a verse here and a verse there, but trying to bring them all together. Like, it's not as simple as just saying verse, chorus, verse.
No.
You know? So I struggled with that a bit, but I'd like to try it again. But I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like you just... I find I get too distracted by too many different things, and I end up spreading myself too thin rather than focusing on certain things. So right now I'm just focusing 100% on film stuff.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a composer come in and take care of it, and I can depend upon them that it will be good, because everything else in the film has basically been myself in terms of the tech side of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, for somebody who has been making films for like 15 years and always, doing it yourself, like get friends mm-hmm. together, do it. What is it like all of a sudden to work with professionals, like people who you can actually, you know, say you are in charge of this mm-hmm. and I will just check up on it instead of it's always being, you know, it's all on you.
Yeah, well, it hasn't totally gotten to that point yet, because the next film will definitely be feel like that. But with this, I started shooting Beauty Day, which I'll just say quickly that it's about a guy named Ralph Zavadil, who did a cable access show in Canada, well, not even Canada, in my hometown, in St. Catharines, Ontario, that was like Jackass.
Yeah.
Can I say Jackass?
Yeah, well, yeah, of course.
So he was like...
We'll put it in quotes if people complain.
He did his show from 1990 to 1995, and he would do weird stunts and skits and, like, you know, eat raw eggs or snort eggs and stuff like that. So he was the original Jackass before Johnny Knoxville and these guys started doing the Jackass show. Ralph did this years before them. And then eventually he did a skit where he wanted to jump off of a ladder into his pool to take the cover off, but the ladder gave way and he fell and he crushed 2 vertebrae in his neck and he had this accident. And from there, things kind of went downhill. Stopped doing the show, and kind of started leading a more normal life. And then, so 20 years later, I come into the picture and I ask him if I can do a film on him, because I was a big fan of his show. And I discover there's all these interesting things that happened to him between then and now. And he ends up doing a 20th anniversary show in the film. So that's kind of the premise of the movie. But I started filming it myself, and then I got my friend Roman to come in and be producer in quotations, because he has no film experience,
but he held the microphone, so that gets producer credit.
He held the mic, he helped setting stuff up and taking stuff down, and he made a lot of the phone calls to set up interviews, which is the stuff that I'm the least interested in.
Yeah, of course.
So he was doing that with me, and then in the middle of shooting I met up with a filmmaker named Kevin McMahon. I reviewed his film on my documentary blog. I sent him the review and I slyly put a promo video of my Beauty Day thing into my email and said, oh, if you have a second, check this out and let me know what you think. And he liked it. Yeah, very smooth. He liked it, and then he offered to meet with me to talk about it. And he then, at that meeting, he offered to take the film and pitch it to his partners, and they all run a production company called Primitive Entertainment. So they pitched it. They liked it.
It should be perfect for, like, Captain Video.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Captain Video is the show Rev did.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a very primitive in terms of technology.
Indeed.
But so they liked it, and they took it on, and they allowed me to continue making the movie with just me and Roman. And Ralph, the subject of the film, he requested that it just be me and Roman still. He didn't want a huge crew around.
No.
But the production side of things got easier. So they would start handling music licensing, looking for clips. At one point, I wanted to do a shot of Ralph jumping into his swimming pool. So they rented a underwater camera unit for me. And so they would start handling that stuff. And I could start sending them requests of, like, I need this, I need that. We need to get a shot of the Toronto skyline. Can you figure out where we can go to get it? And so that was very helpful. And then now, in post-production, they're setting up the stuff with composer and sound mixing and everything, and they've worked out a broadcast deal with the biggest movie network in Canada, and we've gotten a theatrical distribution deal as well. So it's worked out very well. But it will be the future films where I will hopefully have someone that might be there to help me with some technical stuff, or
maybe carry a bag or something.
Yeah, I want to continue shooting my own films,
yeah,
at least for the documentaries.
Yeah.
But all the other stuff, like sound, I would love someone to do sound. Like, that's something I do not want to worry about ever again.
Yeah.
So.
And that is a big worry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm very proud of the sound in the film, because it doesn't in any way feel like... Like, a lot of documentaries, the first thing you notice is the sound is shit.
Yeah, you have to, like, turn the volume up and down at each scene, because it's all screwy.
If it's not bad enough that the cinematography is usually garbage, the sound is garbage. And so we were sure to try and do the best we could with sound. And I think there's not really any moments in the film that stand out as being bad.
Well, I have seen the film... also in the interest of full disclosure, but I didn't notice any sound issue.
Yeah.
It seemed very professional, more professional than I would... maybe not that I would expect, because, as I said, the sort of the video stuff and the short films that you do on the website, they definitely has the same flavor as those, in terms of the cinematography and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it was sort of like what I would expect from, like, on a slightly larger scale.
Yeah,
but it's the same sort of, you know, the same interest in filmmaking you can see shining through.
Well, that's where it's interesting when, like, so that now is my first feature film, and then you look at, like, the little videos that we do on Film Junk. I like the fact that they feel similar. Like,
they definitely
do. The aesthetics or whatever. Yeah. So for me, that's pleasing, because it just means it makes it feel more like I've found something that I'm comfortable with doing aesthetically. And it's, you know, drawing influences from a lot of filmmakers I love, but I've found an area that feels like it's at least my combination of all, like, Werner Herzog and John Carpenter and Errol Morris and whatnot. So I've found an area where I can comfortably shoot. Like, I can confidently say, okay, I'm going to make a film on this, and I will go shoot it, and it will feel like my film, and I will be totally comfortable in how I present it, I guess.
It's sort of, I think somebody asked the Coen brothers about style, and they said, well, you make a movie and it's all about, you know, you make a bunch of decisions.
Yeah.
And then this, at the end, then you have all the decisions are made, and that's the style that ends up. And once you, you reach the point that you talk about, where it's like, now you're confident that you're not going to make a decision that breaks... because you've made the same decision so many times, or at least similar, that you're confident that the end result will be similar.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of the same, you know how to shoot something, where to focus, where to try to do something interesting, where to keep it simple. Those kind of things, which really is very important in determining style.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm in no way an expert. Like, this is my first feature.
You're not the Coen brothers?
No. But
well, I like your films better than the Coen Brothers. All right. The chill, lonely child.
But it's the kind of thing where it's like I lost my train of thought. I guess you just have to get to a point where you're thinking of it more intuitively than overthinking things.
Yeah, that's what I meant by saying when you're no longer worried that you're going to make a decision that'll sort of derail what people perceive as your style, if you haven't gotten in yourself yet, and you're hoping that, well, if I choose to do this, then it'll be cohesive, then it'll have a style. But once you've done it a certain number of times, then you get more confident. When I do this, then it will be cohesive.
Which is a huge thing with documentary filmmaking, because you're always, because I'm directing it, so I'm like steering the conversations, and I'm choosing what I'm filming, but I'm also the camera operator and the cinematographer, and I edit it. So as I'm filming, you know, a conversation, you have to be aware of your coverage and how you're going to edit it, and be sure that, you know, okay, for this part of the conversation, I'm going to shoot over this person's shoulder, and then I'm going to jump over their shoulder and shoot. And then somewhere in between there, I got to get a close-up of their hands so that I can drop that in to hide the cut or whatever. And you constantly have to think on your feet like that, like, because you don't want to end up in the cutting room with, like, this long shot of an interview and you have no way to cut it.
Yeah.
Like, so it's actually fun in that way. Like, it's a challenge to shoot a scene and make it feel as much as possible like a fictionalized drama, but it was reality, and you were capturing it sporadically as it was happening.
Yeah.
And that's with Beauty Day, kind of what I was always doing, was trying to find ways to present the material in a very almost typical fictional fashion, you know, like I wanted it to feel like a comedy or like a dramedy.
Yeah, dramedy.
And I think that's where, you know, my intuition comes in, where, you know, I just kind of start feeling how the scene's going, and I can very quickly decide how I'm going to shoot it and not stress out or suddenly become stuck where it's like, I have no idea how I'm going to approach this. It just is starting to feel more natural, and I'm feeling more confident with that. And it, funny enough, I think that comes from all of the shooting I did as a kid, where we would never have a script or storyboards or anything. It was always like just making it up as we went, and we would do it every weekend just for fun. And I think doing that over and over and over got me into this mindset of like making stuff up on the spot and like choosing angles on the spot.
Yeah, and once you've made like 4 or 5 films where you end up in that situation where you have something that you can't cut away from, then the next time you're like, well, I gotta get,
yeah. And that's where school helped too. Like, a lot of people kind of slag film school and say, you know, don't go to film school, use the money and make a film. That works for some people.
It doesn't work here, because you get paid to go to film school here if you get in. They only let in 4 people every second year.
Lucky you.
we pay 60% taxes. Oh, so. Right. So I don't know how lucky we are.
But yeah, with film school, like, sure, there's, you get like a Quentin Tarantino who didn't go to film school, and
he just made a shitty film instead, according to him.
Yeah, he made like this crappy short film that he didn't even finish.
I think it was a feature, though.
It was a feature, but they never finished filming. It was my best friend's birthday or something like that.
Oh, yeah, right.
But I guess his writing is kind of what got him into the industry. But yeah, he was lucky enough to get to direct his first film. And it's rare that a filmmaker gets to go into the industry with this perfect filmography, you know, where it's all stuff that it's passion projects and you know, Wes Anderson, Quentin Tarantino, P.T. Anderson. Whereas I think the reality is most people won't even direct or work in the industry. They'll lose interest and move on to something else. But the ones who do will end up having to work all these jobs that might not be exactly what they want to be doing. Like, I always think of the guy directed King of Kong, that documentary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He went on to do Four Christmases.
Which is, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you find success with King of Kong. It's like, okay, I can finally jump into feature filmmaking beyond documentary, and you're presented with this romantic comedy Christmas film. And it's like, okay, do I hold off for, I don't know, I shouldn't speak on his behalf, maybe that was a passion project.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But do I hold off and like try and aim for my Reservoir Dogs or whatever, or do I jump on this opportunity and do Four Christmases and get my foot in the door but risk being typecast as the guy who does the romantic comedies or something?
Yeah, risk if maybe, well, as you say, it could have been like maybe he really loved it and it was a passion project, and maybe he rewrote it to fit his own sensibilities and whatnot. But if that didn't happen, like maybe you get the script, but they tell you, well, we got Vince Vaughn and what was it, Reese Witherspoon?
Yeah.
It's like Academy Award winning actors and huge stars, and they're involved with the script, and we want you to direct it. So this is like a major shot at Hollywood.
Yeah.
So even even then, you could like look at the script and maybe say, well, I'm also running the risk of being totally slaughtered by critics and slaughtered by an audience as well if these stars don't push through.
Especially after a film like King of Kong.
Yeah, because King of Kong, that definitely, like, that is like a passion project. It's there is no way you can foresee any sort of success when making a movie like that.
Right.
And the only reason, well, maybe if he, like, knew Billy Mitchell, because I would say that Billy Mitchell is definitely, like, the major reason that film went as big as it did.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think film school was a good experience because you get an opportunity to not just to make films, but to have people sit and look at your film and critique it, and then you get to critique other people's films. And the main thing, aside from like technical stuff, I think the important thing I took from film school is the ability to walk that line of deciding when to like choose your battles. Like if we would be showing a student film to a professor and they would start saying, you know, why'd you do that? I think you should take that out or you should remove that. They don't always want you to just say, okay, yes, I'll take it out.
No. Yeah.
They want you to explain.
They want the justification for the decision, the thought process.
Right. And a lot of responses to that would either be someone just, you know, saying, okay, I'll take it out, whatever you want.
Yeah.
Or it'll be someone just saying, it's my film, I'll do whatever I want. Where you just,
I'm gonna shoot myself shitting.
You have to find that line where you can just take in the criticism that works and helps you and politely decline the stuff that goes against what you think is best for the film, as long as you have a good explanation as to why you think it's the best for the film. And that's an important thing to learn. And for me right now, working with a production company, and they'd helped me with the edit in terms of like kind of story consulting. And it was extremely helpful and useful. And so whenever they would have comments about certain scenes, there was never any tension. It was always like, if they had a question about the scene and didn't think it worked, and I explained to them why it's there and why I think it works, they would say, okay, that's fine. And then if they had something that they're like, no, you know, that really doesn't work, and they would explain to me why, and then I would realize, you know what, you're right, I don't even know why I did that. And it just, you know, it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get into like, you know, art by committee. It's still
no, but personal. It is sort of a more pragmatic approach to the whole, like, the idea of authorship, like whose movie is it, and the way that you like got into the whole business is, from my perspective, sort of a very pragmatic way of like, well, these are the circumstances, this is what real life is, this is sort of what I can do now to gradually improve my chances of getting to this point where I want to be, not just, you know, I'm gonna write the great American novel and put it to film, and if they don't recognize me for it, then to hell with them. It's sort of more like brick by brick, trying to work your way in, trying to hone your craft, and and so that also when you get there, you have something to bring, like other than just like a flash in the pan. Maybe you did something good and you got hired, but like you have like this whole progression of stuff to show people as like, well, I'm serious about this, and and this is how I got at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you go to write a short film and you think, okay, what am I going to write? And there's the people that, you know, especially student films, there's the people who will be like, I want to write this giant, you know, battle scene with Roman soldiers or whatever, like something that's way beyond their means. Whereas the best thing to do is say, okay, I have access to a radio station, so I'll set it in a radio station. I have access to this. Like, you figure out what you have to work with and then use that, and then write about what you know, and you're set. And I think it's the same thing with making connections. And like, I have the documentary blog, and I've used it in every way I can without becoming that obnoxious person that, you know, tries to reach out to everyone like, watch my film, watch my film, watch my film.
Oh, right, right. I was, you kind of lost me. I've used the documentary blog without becoming an obnoxious person.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, it's a good tool for kind of
trying
like,
to spread the word.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, you know, I enjoy documentaries. I love making documentaries. So I made a blog, and now other filmmakers are reading it. And I've got a podcast now where I talk to other filmmakers, so I can bring in all that information I get from them and help that, or that helps me as well in terms of figuring out the best route to take to, you know, make the next project, I guess. Like, that's the important thing, like just keeping it going. And with Beauty Day, I'm very happy with how it turned out, but it's the main thing with that is just getting to the next project. So and it looks like that will be happening, so that's good.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah But it's weird at the festival, because it's like, for the most part, it doesn't even feel like there's a festival going on. Like, when you go to the films, there's no introduction, there's no Q&A, there's no, rarely are there volunteers, like maybe at the door, but there have been a couple theaters I've gone to where there are no volunteers.
Yeah, like last night.
Yeah.
It's like,
you just go in and it's like a normal movie.
It is.
Whereas,
no commercials though.
Yeah.
Which is good.
In like Hot Docs in Toronto or TIFF, it's like, you're very aware. Like, there are lineups outside, and there's like volunteers everywhere with headsets and everything. And
with headsets, I guess they have to communicate somehow.
Yeah, so it's strange. Yeah, it's weird, because I would think, like, if I brought Beauty Day here and it was my premiere, and it plays in a theater, and there's no introduction, and, you know, there's no Q&A, and there's no guarantee that there's even going to be a full theater.
No, I would imagine that, like, oftentimes it's also that, like the guy who made the movie we saw last night, some Russian guy, like, he's not going to come to Denmark for, like, 2 days to introduce his movie to, like, a smaller sized audience. Sometimes they will. There have been some good ones, like last year, I think it was last year, maybe it was the year before, where they had the English Surgeon. You like that movie, right?
Yeah, and I saw that,
and afterwards they had like a Q&A with the director of the film. I think his name is Jeffrey Smith.
Yeah.
And they had like the main guy, whatever his name is, Henry.
Yeah, Henry Marsh.
Yeah, Marsh is right. I don't know if Henry's right.
Something like that.
Yeah, and then they had like a surgeon, a neurosurgeon from a hospital, and they had like this guy who's a Danish director who's retired now, who's like one of the biggest directors, definitely living directors, like top three Danish directors, and like, all these classics and award winning and stuff, and he's amazing. And he's also a doctor. And his dad was one of the leading like neurosurgeons in Denmark, and a pioneer in the field. So that was like a Q&A with these four people, which was pretty cool. Like, sometimes they will have something cool like that. But regularly it's just like you see the film and then nothing else.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense, seeing as it's, you know, a lot of international
Yeah, and it's not like Copenhagen Docs is like the main event for documentary filmmakers around the world, yeah. I'd say.
Yeah.
You'd probably like, you know, definitely something like Hot Docs.
Yeah.
I don't even know how many people live in Toronto.
I don't know. 5 million, maybe?
Well, that's like more or less the population of Denmark then.
Yeah.
So you'd probably rather premiere it there. Well, Toronto, they have like, well, I guess Copenhagen now has two festivals as well. We have it's called Copenhagen Picks for like fictional films, but definitely the Toronto International Film Festival is one of the premier.
Yeah.
So Toronto is kind of known for being like a movie city. So something like that is a lot more high. So if that's what you're used to, then I can see why this would feel like it's not even a real festival.
I guess Hot Docs is one of the premier documentary festivals. So.
Well, just being in Toronto, I would say, is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. The only shitty thing with festivals, that's been the most annoying thing with the whole process with Beauty Day, because you have to premiere, like, Hot Docs. If you premiere at Hot Docs, you can't get into TIFF. So,
But TIFF has documentaries as well. Yeah, I guess it had like that Jimmy Page crappy documentary.
Yeah, but they require a Canadian premiere, so you can't have played anywhere in Canada.
Oh, if you're going to TIFF, then you have to premiere
at TIFF,
there. Okay.
Yeah. And at Hot Docs, it's the same thing. You have to. I think it's, or it might just be Ontario, or no, it might just be Toronto. So you
it has
really
to be
have
a Toronto premiere.
Yeah, so you really have to strategize like where you're gonna premiere, and then if I premiere here, it knocks out these festivals.
Yeah.
And, like when I went to the Flyway Film Festival in Wisconsin, I would have liked to have brought Beauty Day there.
Yeah, of course.
But it would have meant I premiered at Flyway in Wisconsin and couldn't do Sundance, couldn't do this or that. So I'll probably bring it next year after we've done whatever festivals we do.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It'll be interesting because I think.
Well, if you bring it next year, then you have to do a Q&A.
Yeah.
Because you're now on record as complaining there's not enough Q&As.
Yeah, that's true. Which is weird because the Q&As to me, like, I don't know. I guess they could be fun, but
yeah, they're only as good as the questions, and the questions are oftentimes not very exciting.
Yeah. The Q&A I had in Wisconsin was good for Cooking with Jerry, because I got to tell my colon cancer story, which I didn't expect to do. But someone asked in the audience, because they had seen last year the Calore Non Vedenti thing with the food, and with Cooking with Jerry, it was poutine as well. So it was Jello in one and poutine in the other.
Right.
And they're like, "Do you have some sort of problem with food?" I was like, "Well, actually," so it worked out quite well.
And if anybody wants to hear the what is it called? The colon cancer story. This has like the official name now.
I guess, yeah.
It's on a certain episode of Film Junk. I think it's a review of Resident Evil something, but it's also on YouTube, so you can just search for Film Junk colon cancer, and it'll come right up. 10 minutes of some pretty hilarious discoveries into Jay's body.
But yeah, the Q&As are hit and miss, I think. But
yeah, for sure. But it's at least nice to see that the director took the time to like get up there, and if the questions are shit, then the questions are shit, but it at least shows also balls that you're like, well, maybe you get some wise ass in the audience. Like, I have been in some audiences, and you get frustrated with, like, boring questions, so you're like, well, I'm gonna, you know, ramp up the troll a little bit, and just to try and get something out of them, so sort of squeeze them a little bit.
Response.
Yeah. I remember I sort of challenged in The English Surgeon the idea of the sort of the overarching sort of sentimental story was in there, where he goes visit with the family and stuff, and I tried to like poke at that a little bit.
Yeah.
And the response was good, I think. But it's like, it's not something that was a big deal for me watching the movie. But like sitting in an audience where nobody asks anything and these people are sitting up there and then somebody asks something and it's like, well, they asked the doctor, well, what is it like where you live in Ukraine or whatever? Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, yeah, let's try and see if we can get something.
Well, a question like that doesn't even... Like, it seems like it's a criticism, but there's nothing wrong with just wanting a director to explain the reasoning for something.
I think so as well. And you know, I've never experienced any director sort of like an angry response. They're always like, well, because I did pay to see the goddamn movie, so and if they are standing up to like, well, ask me questions, then I'm gonna ask a question and you should answer it.
Yeah.
And I've never experienced anything other than like a willingness to, and it shows confidence in your own film as well, that you're like, well, I can take whatever you sling at me, and even if you sort of poke where it hurts a little bit, they will oftentimes be very willing to like admit or accept that, like, yeah, well, maybe there is some limitations here to my work or something, and I'm aware of it, but that's just how it ended up or something like that,
yeah,
and without sort of getting in a hissy fit about it.
Yeah, I've seen that at Q&As as well.
And yeah,
I mean, it's in their best interest to keep sort of, you know, not get too defensive.
And, yeah, and definitely
too high, you know, in their own, you know, that their film is perfect or and it's usually true. Like the filmmakers usually have a point where they end up having to compromise something, and maybe there's an area in the film that they know could be stronger, and when someone points it out, you can't do anything other than just agree and say, yeah, that's something we would have liked to have done a little better, but what can you do?
Yeah, and definitely.
It is what it is. But I'm curious to see what the reception will be for Beauty Day when it starts doing festivals, because I think it's going to be one of those...
Are you going to do Sundance, though?
We've entered it, but I would bet my genitalia that it won't get in.
That's quite a bet.
That is quite a bet. Just beyond whether or not the film is good, the numbers are not in anyone's favor.
Right.
It's like, I think they take 16 documentaries or something out of probably 2,000 or something. So the chances are very slim, even if you have an awesome film.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, add the whole element of like...
They probably want American films as well.
Well, that, and then they know certain filmmakers, like, you know, you're going to... If Werner Herzog has a film that's out, they want the Werner Herzog film. So that's one slot gone. And so it really is probably more like 6 films that they'll dedicate to like taking a chance on smaller people. But I don't know. We'll be doing festivals. I'm just not sure which ones.
Oh, well, you can never be sure, I guess.
Yeah, it's harder with character-driven documentaries too.
Really?
Usually,
it's harder to like sum up in a like a pitch, I guess. So like, if you submit your film and you give like a small synopsis.
Yeah, like the original Jackass. You know.
Yeah, it's
it seems very shallow and. It's one of those things where I think if I didn't start shooting the film and I didn't have a piece of footage to show someone, they wouldn't be interested. Like if I just wrote a pitch, like a
trailer, yeah.
It on paper, it doesn't sound as interesting. So you really have to kind of see it. But I think it's also, you
make such an eclectic title as well. You should have called it something with like Incorporated or CEO or something, because fucking financial documentaries are all the craze.
Yeah, yeah.
So you should have did some sort of side story where it's like trying to start up a company or something, and the crisis hit. And then you're in, man.
Or some green element.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Going green.
Green Day. Call it Green Day. Yeah.
But
then people will be flocking to theaters. Seeing, have you seen the Green Day documentary? Green Day
very
documentary.
Disappointed. Yeah. But yeah,
it's about a guy planting a tree.
It's tough to get attention to films that aren't about issues. And,
yeah. Because where's the audience for these kind of things? I mean, you know, I watched them. They're at like the core, like the hardcore festival audience.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a regular person could sit down and watch a documentary about, you know, the financial crisis, because it seems like it's something that's of general interest, or even like food, Food Incorporated or whatever. Like, we all eat, so food is pretty. But like some sort of like just a story about a guy who you have no idea who is. Mm-hmm. And the first thing you ask is like, well, why is there even a movie about it? Blah, blah, blah. And it's so... I can definitely see, like, from a festival side, they want to fill the seats, obviously. Yeah. So they want something that also looks good in the program, mm-hmm. and something that people will think that they need to see.
Yeah, I think that maybe people feel that they can't get an environmental film from a dramatic film. Like, they go to something like Inconvenient Truth, because that is a film that's specific to the documentary genre, if you want to call it a genre.
It's about real life.
Yeah, it's like, it's numbers, it's facts, it's not something you would see in a scripted actor film.
No, definitely, very
Whereas
different.
You get a documentary that's a character study, and people might be more likely to say, well, I'd rather just watch, you know, a Wes Anderson movie or like a scripted film.
Well, your film Beauty Day definitely like lots of similarities to like Aronofsky's The Wrestler, which was I don't know if it was a big hit. I mean, for me it was a pretty big hit, but I don't know if it made a lot of money. But if you take that sort of film, it's not a blockbuster by any means, and you sort of take the documentary sort of equivalent of it, and you get it to an even smaller audience, and most likely a lot of the audience that would see the documentary would also have seen The Wrestler, and they would be like, well, maybe it's not as gripping as that, and whatever. So it is a tough sort of thing to pull off.
Yeah, because you're always contending with the fact that, you know, every once in a while there will be films that are where reality is stranger than fiction.
Yeah,
but you have to contend with the scripted films, and you don't always have the freedom to do the most dramatic stuff. Like it is, you're dealing with whatever you have to deal with.
Yeah,
and for me, the way to combat that is obviously to have interesting stories and whatnot. But it's the characters, having interesting characters. And then the presentation, like that's where I think modern documentary filmmaking is interesting. Is it's not even the whole thing of the mixing of fiction and nonfiction, but it's the incorporation of style, where you're pulling stylistic choices from dramatic filmmaking, for lack of a better term, and incorporating it into documentary filmmaking to present it as a cinematic experience.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, okay, well, this is a documentary, so we can shoot it on mini DV video and it can be handheld and sound like shit. And
yeah, and we'll have like a PowerPoint presentation of like the facts. And
yeah.
And an animated sequence.
Yeah.
Funny South Park characters will debate an issue.
Yeah, I think you just have to, you have to still take the story and just present it as cinematically as possible. And like with Beauty Day, I decided to do it in the 2:3:5:1 aspect ratio, like the CinemaScope, and which is not usual. It's not normal for documentaries. It's been happening more often now, but and just being very aware of presenting things. Like there's a montage in Beauty Day, which I wanted to do very early on. Because I don't think I've seen like a montage in a documentary, like outside of the typical understanding of what a montage is. Yes, I've seen that in a documentary, but in the
some documentaries are all montages.
Yeah, but in the sense of like a 1980s action genre film montage where you see someone suiting up and to like some montage music, like the cliched version of what a montage is.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen that in a documentary as sort of portrayed as cliched as I portray it, like purposely cliched.
Yeah, and that's something that's like in every other fictional film like ever made, especially action movies. They always have like some sort of ramping up for the final battle and whatever.
Which is interesting with documentary, because when you start pulling in cliches from Hollywood filmmaking into a real story, it makes it feel fresh, because it's like you start thinking, okay, this is real life, but it's playing on screen like a movie, and it just adds this weird perspective to it.
Yeah.
Whereas I think it works the opposite as well, obviously, because it's been very popular to take documentary techniques and apply it to fiction filmmaking, and then you start thinking, okay, I know I'm watching something that's fake, but it feels like it's real.
Yeah.
And I think that works both ways. So that's what interests me, even in just in terms of the actual filmmaking. The act of making the film is more fun by trying to make it as cinematic as possible. And
also, like, in documentaries, I would not say in a lot of them, but, like, in some of them I find this, which is completely not there in fictional filmmaking, sort of like this playfulness with the entire idea of making the movie as well. Because there's less emphasis on all the sort of technical brilliance of lighting and sound design. Sometimes that sort of idea will be embraced, and they will have this sort of playful approach to the whole thing, where they can't do, for instance, like you say, never been done before, but like a montage where it's like, well, it's not, we know that this is like a cliche, and it's like, it's almost like a comedic thing, because by now a montage could easily be in a regular movie could easily be perceived as like, well, are they parodying themselves, because we've seen these forever, right? But like that whole approach, like, well, we're gonna take this material that we got, which is real and which is real shit and whatever, but then we're gonna sort of play around with it, try and see if we can make it a little more fun or jazz it up or whatever. Try and do something interesting with it.
I mean, taking Ralph in the film and his friend Robert, and the idea is taking them and with him doing this 20th anniversary show, making them look like rock stars, basically, like having you so, as an audience member, so on their side and like so pumped to see them back in action. And whereas in a fictional film, it might, like you said, feel like it's making fun.
You roll your eyes because it's like, well, you can't get me on board with these techniques because I've seen these techniques like in 50 films before this.
Whereas in a documentary, it suddenly feels fresh because you're dealing with real people.
And but it also gives us like sort of the playfulness. I know you hate this word, but it also gives us like this meta thing. Because as an audience, we realize that these people did not get suited up in this way, except that there was a camera there and it's edited and there's music to it, so that it looks like they did it. And that's sort of what I meant with like this playful. So we know that we're not supposed to take it seriously. We know that the film is not trying to hammer this sense of whatever emotion it is into us, because we know that the filmmakers know that we know that this is not that this is something that's just a regular thing. Like it's real. So it's, they just did it like everything is done in real life without all the hype and stuff. So it's not as much like the filmmaker is trying to convince you that this is hyped up, but it's sort of like, well, wouldn't it be fun if we tried to make it hyped up and sort of get on board with like, let's pretend that this is sort of like a big deal, because then it's more fun to watch it.
It just helps with the storytelling as well. Like it's another tool to get the audience on board, and for me it was a good tool because one of the guys in the film, Robert, wasn't totally sure what I had in mind and what I was all about, and he was kind of cautiously taking part in the film. And after I cut together this montage and showed it to him, he was like completely blown away and so excited to see him and Robert, or him and Ralph, looking like rock stars, and and then he loosened up a bit, and it was a good way to get him on my side, I guess. But I mean, I wouldn't. Obviously, it's a case by case thing. Like, I wouldn't force a montage into a film about terminal cancer kids or something.
No, the doctor suiting up.
Yeah, for
probably be a little appropriate.
But when you can indulge in stuff like that, it can be fun, and I think it can be. It can have a purpose.
Like, and a movie like Beauty Day obviously lends itself to sort of this playful approach, because it's about a guy who's basically, you know, playing.
Oh, well, I mean, that's the thing. It's about a guy who
doing stuff
made TV shows by himself for no reason other than to just make TV shows by himself.
Yeah.
So when we're doing this 20th anniversary, the only thing that's changed is I'm now filming him and he's got his friend with him, and it's like where normally a documentary crew remains completely objective, and we didn't really, like when we were filming him doing his new stunts, we were almost not there in many ways. Like I would just be filming and they'd forget we're even there. But then every once in a while it would be like, you know what, Ralph, it'd be cool if you, don't you think it'd be cool if you put some fireworks in there or did this or whatever.
Yeah.
And it felt more like, you know, it wasn't interfering with reality, but it was capturing the reality of four creative people having fun making something.
Yeah.
Like there's a shot in the film of him, of Ralph on his motorized skateboard that he used to ride in the show. And this really nice shot of him going by these greenhouses, and that shot is in the movie and it's part of the montage, and he's not filming his show at that point. Like that shot exists as just eye candy. And we went out onto the streets with Ralph. Robert, one of the subjects, drove the van with me in it. So he's now my assistant camera guy in a way. And I'm shooting Ralph out of the van. And it's not a part of his 20th anniversary. It's for my film. So it's like it's that creative spirit is spilling over into my film, where they're now doing Ralph's show, but they're also helping me do my documentary. Like it's a...
Yeah.
Which, where normally, you know, you could say, okay, well, this is staged. He's not shooting a show. You're just doing cool shots. And it's like, well, the whole thing is about the creative process. It's about being with friends and having fun and making this goofy TV show. And the documentary is now dipping into that TV show for this moment, you know? So I thought that was a fun kind of way to look at it, and a fun way to... for me to be a part of what Ralph was doing.
That definitely is like a fine line to sort of find where do you interfere. But yeah. I think like very important thing is like, what, as long as the subjects are aware of, like if you ask them, can you do this? What do you think about this? Like sort of suggestions, then they will obviously always have the option to say no, as long as you're not like whipping them or like doing ultimatums and whatever. Like if you can do it in that sense, then they will always have the option to like say, well, now you're kind of interfering with what I'm going to do. Like for instance, in the Metallica documentary, well, that was like a big deal, and they even have it in the movie where they discuss how the film affects like the subjects and whatnot.
Yeah.
And that's obviously something that's very interesting about documentaries, and sort of have the fun a lot of the time, definitely with like the character documentaries, is how they react to the camera and how they react to the whole idea of being a documentary subject.
Yeah.
But I think as long as you have them in the process in that way, then you're sort of in the clear, like morally or whatever. Once you get into the editing room, that's where you really have to like be careful with the tightrope, because there you can really manipulate people, and you can do stuff that like helps the film, but sells like it throws somebody under the bus and whatnot.
Yeah.
And even though you're like, well, I have no intention of throwing this guy under the bus. I really like him, but like the film is 200% better if I just do the cut here instead of here, even though it makes him look like an idiot.
Yeah.
Then you have like this really tough, and that's where you have to walk like the tightrope, where, well, what's more important, the real life sort of connection or what it's called, relationship, or the film.
Well, yeah, I mean, with Beauty Day, there's not really too much deep stuff that threatens Ralph's persona or his reputation. No. So I didn't have to worry about that too much. But I guess the way that, like, there are some unflattering things in the film in terms of him, like the drug bust and all these things. And that stuff is in there because he decided he was cool with having it in there. And the reason he decided he was cool with having it in there is because we spent time getting to know each other, and he realized I was trying to tell a story, and he started to come around, like, he started to realize that by having this element, like, you should know that at one point this happened to me, because you might, that might be good for the film, and you might be interested in that. If not, that's fine. And then I would say to him, okay, yeah, that does sound interesting, and it would go in the film if, you know, if I thought it worked in the film.
Yeah.
And he has said he wants to watch the first cut of the film in the theater, like, when it premieres.
So he hasn't seen it yet?
No, he's seen bits and pieces.
Yeah.
But for all he knows, I could have made him look like an idiot.
Yeah.
But that's the
maybe he's seeing this as, like, another, just another stunt. Like, he was always putting himself in danger.
Yeah.
Now it's just in another kind of danger, I guess.
Well, when I first met him, he said, as I'm cool with whatever, as long as you don't make my family or my dogs look like idiots.
There is an amazing scene with the dogs in the film, though.
Yeah, yeah. There are two great scenes. One where people get this perception that he's mistreating dogs.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of counterbalanced with this scene of him and his own dogs. He's a big dog lover.
Very tender moment.
Yeah. And it's been a very interesting relationship because I got to know Robert and Ralph very well, and I have become friends with them. And I think there is one moment where Robert in the film goes on this 9/11 conspiracy theory thing, and that was like a completely real moment, and I put it in the film, and it's kind of, you know, that was one thing that came up in the editing process that, you know, you could lose that and it wouldn't change anything in the film, and I argued to keep it because I just felt it was a very real moment of them and working together in their shop, and it's like water cooler talk.
It
feels like the camera isn't even there. So I kept it, but then after we filmed that scene, Robert kind of calmed down and he said, you know, I shouldn't have talked about that. I don't want that in the film. And so then I cut it in, and normally I think a filmmaker would just put it in. He signed something. He signed it, an agreement.
Well, if they really wanted it, then...
Yeah, they can put it in.
Yeah, yeah.
But I told him he could look at it, and if he really felt uncomfortable about it, I'll take it out.
Cause it's not essential to the film in that sense, so you have that luxury of...
But I explained to him why it's in there and why I think it should stay in there, and I told him, I don't think you look stupid. I mean, it's in there for this reason. And he watched it, and he was cool with it, so it stayed. But, you know, I guess you have to choose right at the beginning of the process what kind of relationship you're going to have with the subject.
Yeah.
Are you going to be that kind of person with the subject
where are you gonna be friends with them,
or are you just, you're making the film and it is what it is? And so I decided to go in that direction and let them have some input. Not I don't want them to control the film.
No. If it had been like a bigger deal or something, maybe let's say if Ralph, he didn't want his daughter in the film or something, that would have been a bigger sort of...
It's not like they're sitting in the editing room with me and saying, I don't like how I look there.
Yeah.
But if there was any major concerns, I was at least open to talking about it.
Yeah.
So I was happy with that approach, and I'm confident that there's nothing in there that they'd be upset about, and I think Ralph will be very happy with the film, and he's happy with what he's seen so far. So,
yeah, I think he will be quite happy as well. I only know him through the film, but I can't imagine anything else.
Yeah.
But I think we have to wrap this up right now. I have some shout outs that I have to make.
Okay.
The first one is to a man named Kasper Løvborg. He is the only guy in Denmark that I've met and actually made into a fan of Film Junk.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I introduced Film Junk to him and he started listening.
What's
his
name?
Kasper Løvborg. It's not the same Kasper.
It's not the same Kasper.
No, okay. Who wrote for Film Junk at one point. It's not him. But actually, I met him through studies. And he is right now in Toronto.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's studying there, and he was at TIFF, and he messaged me on Facebook and said, well, what the hell, now I'm in Toronto, and all of a sudden Jay's in Copenhagen. Yeah. And he actually messaged me one time, a couple of months ago, where he said, like, I'm pretty sure I just saw Reed Farrington on the streets of Toronto.
There's a lot of Asian people in Toronto. He probably just saw another Asian guy.
It might be. Do they all look like Reed Farrington?
I'm not saying that. Yeah, maybe. Actually, Reed's dad lives in Toronto.
So oh, he maybe he saw Reed's dad.
Every couple of weekends. So.
Okay. Yeah, it could be.
Was it at like a junk store or something?
It was at that crazy place where he buys like 5 gallons of whatever food items and whatnot. Oh, what's it called?
Liquidation World.
Yeah. Yeah. The second shout out is, of course, to your good friend, my good friend, Doug Nagy. I just wanted him to be mentioned. He's very missed. I was hoping a little bit he would come because he said he had time off.
Oh,
but
yeah.
No dice. Maybe next year, maybe some other time, I will finally get to meet him in the cold. I know he enjoys the cold. I promised last night I would give a shout out to Goon as well. and I hope he enjoys his CDs.
Yes, I successfully picked up some albums he wanted me to get, so...
Cool shit, man.
Yeah. I'll give a shout-out to not people, but my websites.
Right, right.
Documentaryblog.com, filmjunk.com, and you can follow me at twitter.com/jcheel, and Beauty Day, www.beautydaydocumentary.com.
And at filmjunk.com, there are in the sidebar there are ways to view all of the short films, like The Running Tunnel, which is a very short, like 8-minute film, Colorin on Redenti, which is like 25 minutes.
Yeah,
it's a horror comedy, which is you know, I would say like an accomplished film. The length is a little tricky. Because 25 minutes is a really strange length for a film.
Too long for a short and too short for a feature.
Exactly. So. But it is, like, completely accomplished. The Running Tunnel is made in, like, 24 hours.
Yeah,
so there's a little less. And then there are, like, there's some video stuff from way back where it was, like, reviews and stuff. And then there's the Reed Farrington house tours which are fucking amazing.
His Cooking with Jerry stuff.
Oh yeah, the Cooking with Jerry as well, which is also amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the one that he made himself. I think was pretty mind-blowing when I saw that the first time.
I think we're going to be doing a Christmas Cooking with Jerry, so
definitely looking forward to that. Well, and also did you have something?
I guess the Beauty Day documentary website, you can check for how to see it once it's doing festival runs and stuff, which will be next year, early next year.
2011.
Yes.
And final shout out has to be to Sean Dwyer making so much shit, making LOL happen, being completely calm and bald, never raising his voice at any point during five years of podcasting.
Yeah. And doing, it amazes me how he keeps up the blogging and working full time. And he is a passionate blogger.
And he also still has time to get good at like Guitar Hero and stuff.
Yeah.
Which it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
quite a guy. I wish he was here as well. He should come next year as well.
Yeah. Speaking of Guitar Hero, they should listen to his podcast Game Junk.
Oh, right. On filmjunk.com, there is also another podcast called gamejunk.com, just called Game Junk, and it goes up on the site, and you can find it on iTunes and whatever. And that is actually also amazing, if you like video games, of course. It's
and
a really good podcast.
They work in the video game industry, so it's kind of
an
insider perspective in a way.
They're all programmers and huge fans of playing games all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a great show. Well, I could do shout outs.
Thanks for
having me. Well, I'm
thanks
just
for
so
letting
glad.
Me listen to your shout outs.
Well, I'm glad you took the time to be here, and I hope you enjoyed the country.
The
1 square mile of it that you got to see.
I enjoyed the McDonald's. It was
really good. The McDonald's, yeah. Well, it's such a great Danish tradition. Well, that's it, folks.